Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 343, I chat with technology consultants Jeff Tully and Ron Williams about the HPA Tech Retreat. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded March 2nd, 2017. Episode 343, HPA Tech Retreat 2017. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Zipcar. Zipcar is the largest car-sharing network in the world. To earn $25 in driving credit, visit joinzipcar.com/twit. And by BarkBox. BarkBox paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys for your dog and ships them right to your door. To receive a free month of BarkBox with your 6 or 12-month subscription and free shipping, visit getbarkbox.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geeks include Jeff Tully, an entertainment technology consultant and a previous guest on the show. Hey, Jeff, welcome back.
Good to be here, Scott.
Always great to have you here. And also Ron Williams. I guess we would say you're a video technology consultant, Ron.
That'll work.
Close enough. Well, you've been on the show too, so welcome back to you as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you here. Those who are tuned in to the live stream at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there, or you can go to irc.twit.tv, and I'll be watching the chat room, and you can post questions for our guests as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It helps to put my name in the message, my screen name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes, because then it shows up in a different color and I can see it more easily. So what we're talking about today is an event that Jeff and Ron were both at last week, the whole week as it happens, called the HPA Tech Retreat. And so I want to start with, what the heck is HPA? Jeff, let's start with you.
Okay. It is, this year, it is an association that's a part of the Society for Motion Picture Television Engineers. The HPA now stands for the Hollywood Professional Association. People have watched our previous podcasts the years past. We've talked about the HPA as the Hollywood Post Alliance. As of last year, the organization became a subgroup within SMPTE. But it basically is a group of professionals who join because of their affiliation with the movie and home entertainment production community, production and post-production community in and around Hollywood, although the membership certainly stretches well outside
the geographic the LA area of Hollywood. Yeah, right.
Yep. In fact, the group has this tech retreat, which we had have been having now for a number of years, a couple of decades almost, in Palm Desert area, Palm Springs area. Mm-hmm. Is now getting cloned. They had their first event last year and have a call for papers out now for an HPA tech retreat in the UK. So European members who have been coming here each year have reached enough of a critical mass and membership and interest that they'll be holding similar events to the one that Ron and I just attended here in the UK as well.
Now, I have a couple of photos of the venue. We'll start with that. It's at a hotel in Indian Wells, specifically. There it is. Lovely spot, Ron, huh?
Absolutely. And the HPA does a marvelous job of accommodating. This year, I think they cut it off at 650 people.
Holy smokes. Wow.
The venue is extraordinary, and they take very, very good care of us for the accommodations, the food and the breaks and everything. And it's run extremely well, right on the clock. We have a moderator, Mark Schubin, who is quite a character in himself.
Yes, we have a picture of Mark, actually. If we can find that picture of Mark Schubin, we'll see.
He runs it on the clock by the second.
Mm. There's Mark.
And if you're mid-sentence, he just cuts you off and moves right on. Doesn't care. Just, you're out. Goodbye.
Well, and you know what? That's actually really good, because there are so many times we go to these things, types of things, and people drone on and on. And, you know, it's almost like we have to play them off like the orchestra at the Oscars.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Mark doesn't truck with that kind of violation of schedule. That no. Around his neck, you saw that sort of a little squeeze horn there. That
I was
red
wondering
ball.
What that was.
Well, it makes an extremely unavoidable, loud honking noise. He uses that to attract attention during the breaks when they're getting ready to resume the sessions. But should he get a speaker who thinks he can go past the time limit, Mark's been known to honk him into submission. So,
well, that's great. I'm looking forward to having Mark on the show. I haven't had him on the show before, but he's a very interesting character, Ron, as you pointed out.
Oh,
and
he is.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Mark falls into the category of, I know several people that I have great respect for, that I say that when they pass, you have to take their brain and freeze it, because when in the future they figure out how to bring somebody back, the knowledge in that man is just incredible.
Wow.
He's a walking encyclopedia. I mean, he can spit off statistics off the top of his head that would take you 10 minutes to research on Google.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he also has a great history, a great knowledge of the history of television as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Really amazing. Really amazing. One other picture I want to show is Howard Luck, who has been a guest on my show as well. And he is, I think, currently the director of standards at SMPTE. There's Howard asking a question.
Yeah, he's the director of engineering for the SMPTE.
SMPTE engineering, okay. And he's actively involved in standards, making them happen and codifying them and so on. So he's another important guy that's there, I think, every year. And then we have a picture of the innovation zone, which is like the exhibit area.
Right.
And Ron, you spent a lot of your time there, because you actually were representing Grass Valley at the tech retreat. Tell us what you were doing there.
Correct. The unique thing about the HPA for the exhibit area is they have very strict rules. The product that you show has to be a new product that is deliverable in this year, the calendar year, and it has to be something that's innovative into the industry. So it's not like a manufacturer shows up with the stuff he's been showing for the last 2 years and it's the same old stuff and they're using it as a sales venue. This is very specific about the type of technology, the timing of the product, and its availability. So it can't be old and it can't be, you know, vaporware, you know, that's
right.
Maybe we're going to do something. It has to be real and deliverable. So that cuts, you know, the exhibit space down quite a bit
Yeah.
So what Grass Valley was showing this year is two issues. The IP, now that the world is moving over onto IP, transfer of audio, video, data, and
that's
control.
IP as in internet protocol, not intellectual property.
Yes. Well, you know,
there's that too.
The property goes along with it as well.
yeah, exactly. So Grass Valley is moving with everybody else, really, towards transporting content, at least around professional facilities, over IP. Of course, it's being streamed to consumers as well, so that's That's another part of that IP landscape.
This area in the professional side, the IP is for the infrastructure of the production houses and remote trucks and just moving signals around in a facility. Right now, say with UHD, we're running four coaxes and two audio cables and a control cable. Well, you go to IP, it's all on a Cat 5 or Cat 7. You know, everything goes together on a small wire.
Right.
So that was, and they've just released, SMPTE has released several new standards for that. And what Grass Valley was showing was they are the first to be compliant to the new standards. And they, Grass Valley also is very instrumental in I'm trying to think what AIM actually means. It's AIM, which is a consortium of manufacturers who agree on how they will transport protocols so that everybody talks to everybody.
Mm.
So there's not any, you know, specific product specific transport. So if you buy several different products, they're all going to talk to each other and they're all going to work. So everybody plays nice.
I keep hoping for that sort of thing in the consumer world as well. And we have it with HDMI. But I remember it when I was covering electronic music, we were talking about that before the show started, that this communication protocol called MIDI, Musical Instrument Digital Interface, was developed by all of the companies that were making electronic music products at the time that were ostensibly competitors, and yet they recognized the value of coming together, sending their engineers all into one room and saying, give us something that will make all of our products interoperable, easily interoperable. And you're saying that this is sort of what's happening here with this AIM.
Right, because the SMPTE standards, in some cases, is just the envelope. And what is put in it is up to the manufacturer, depending on his specific equipment. So the AIM process is like the UHD signal is going on a 12 gig line. Well, what do you use? Well, if you got a 10 bit pipe and you got a 12 bit signal, you use TECO compression, which is a 4-to-1 compression. So now you can take that 12 gig signal and throw it down a 10 gig line. So it's little things like that the professionals are kind of working out, and it's working well. Mm-hmm. So that was what was in the booth. And then what I was kind of shepherding through is in doing HDR, I did HDR in motion picture for a long time. And then when it went to digital cinema, I was involved in that. And we went to digital capture for motion pictures. We had an issue with high dynamic range. Because then when we got into that, we had, and you and I have talked about this on previous shows, you have wide gamut color, you have high frame rate, you've got high dynamic range, you got high resolution. So those are the four main issues to be chased in following film. Well, in some cases, we've exceeded film digitally.
Yep.
And one of the things that has now become commonplace, obviously, with the TV sets is you get a UHD HDR TV. Well, that's really great, but what flavor of HDR are we talking about?
Oh, man. Yeah, I know. Another multiple standard situation here.
Right. Jeff has got an insight on the overall of, that the TV side and that battle. But what I was demonstrating is that out of a broadcast television camera, for the first time, not only does HDR in the Grass Valley does all four flavors, but in the transition period between the standard dynamic range and the high dynamic range, we've got a crossover period similar to standard def and high def TV. Mm-hmm. As we're going from high def into UHD, there's a crossover. And in some cases, it's going well, and some isn't. But I'll let Jeff go on to, because I know his paper was very well received on saying what resolution is acceptable for HDR, UHD or HD HDR. So what I was showing is the camera outputting 1080p 60 in
That is high definition 1080p at 60 frames per second.
Right. And now in high dynamic range. Well, the controversy is, well, from the acuity test from consumers looking at UHD sets, UHD HDR versus high definition standard TV in HDR, they're finding that the consumer doesn't see a whole lot of difference. And unless you've got that close proximity to UHD, where UHD is apparent to you,
the value, the extra detail in 4K, what sometimes UHD is called,
right? You get back 6-7 feet on a UHD set if it's not a huge one, 120 inches or something. If you're down to your 60-inch TV, you're not really seeing much of a difference. So the
in terms of detail.
So the broadcasters are saying, well, time out. Jeff, I'm not going to step on your discussion.
Finish that thought, then let's go to Jeff.
Okay. They're wrestling with it. So I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Yeah. Jeff, you actually gave a paper on this subject. Tell us sort of what you were proposing and what you were talking about there.
Well, I wasn't so much proposing as kind of reminding the people in this community some of the key points that have been around the discussion. And a lot of it comes to, first of all, being clear what you're talking about. UHD, Ultra HD, has been with us for a while in conversation, and then it's also in a couple of different places where it's part of a brand on or a logo identification of products of one sort or another. And HDR, the high dynamic range, is an element, a thing which is new in televisions. It's newer than the 4K resolution in terms of time frame of when it became available that consumers could buy it. But because the Ultra HD 4K TVs came first. When they first came out, there was no form of 4K content available other than demo material that came from the manufacturers. The TV sets would upscale broadcast or
Blu-ray.
Hook them to a Blu-ray, but the Blu-rays were HD, full HD, full HD with 3D, what have you. But there wasn't actually any content being produced for home distribution in this 4K resolution. And the color space that was used, again, for home distribution, Rec. 709, maybe even some standard definition is 601. So the color space wasn't radically different. The resolution had twice as many dots, but as Ron pointed out, it's a form of mathematics to say how close do you have to be to the screen before you can resolve the dots. And it doesn't take very far beyond that range to not be able to see the difference, regardless of the quality of your eyeballs. It's just not about that. It's about the distance of your eyes to the pixels on the screen.
And the overall human limits on visual acuity. How much detail can the human eye see? I mean, we are physical creatures. We have these eyes that can see down to a certain detail. And if you go beyond that, you're not going to see any better. And that's the whole question about, do we really need 4K? Of course, the TV manufacturer said, yes, absolutely. It's a bigger number. And we can make it easily, especially with the LCD TVs. So let's do it. Well, okay, but you're opening a Pandora's box here.
Well, and it's got multiple doors on the box because
very good.
There's some really good arguments for why people that live in a world of HD or broadcast as HD, cable television, many stations are at full HD, some still are at 720p, which is a kind of high definition, but not the full up. The 1080p, the progressive 1080 resolution, is the full HD, and that's your Blu-ray discs and a fair amount of broadcast. No.
I have to correct you there. There is no 1080p broadcast. It's all 1080i.
Yes. Sorry.
Ron, am I correct about that?
That's true. That's where, you know, I think, I don't want to step on Jeff, but that's where he's going with what the broadcasters are saying. If we're going to make this big jump, we're going to jump to 1080p instead of UHD. Because if we go to UHD, we all have to have new transmitters because we're going to ATSC 3.0. Yeah. And who's going to pay for the new transmitters?
Right. They just updated those transmitters to HD maybe, what, 10, 15 years ago?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, yep. Jeff, sorry to interrupt.
No, we should. Nonetheless, with the ability through traditional distribution means to get 1080 signals into the living room, the 4K TV still has some characteristics that are useful to you. When they have, and all of them pretty much today do, have good upscaling capability. They can get the 1080 signal in and upscale it quite nicely. What you get as a result of that is a better looking HD picture. The oversampling that's in the cameras today that are being used to produce the content and most of the production workflows today that people use actually capture more information in the program at HD resolution than is capable of being shown on an HD resolution TV that you would buy. So that when you buy the 4K TV, you're not imagining things if you think your Blu-ray discs look better or right. your broadcast TV show or what have you. There's a basis in reality for that. And this is, you know, a good news piece for the TV manufacturers as they add other features like high dynamic range and so on. The 4K resolution really isn't something that I think people are going to clamor for. That's too much. You know, give me a good 2K TV instead. I think those days are mostly gone. There's not a big use case for certainly for the large screens, the 55, 65, 70-inch home TVs, HD resolution, 2K resolution is going away pretty rapidly.
It is in
that dimension. And the prices for the 4Ks are quite reasonable. If you're just buying a new television set, whether you have a burning need to have 4K or not, you're probably going to get a better deal and a better quality picture with the 4K TVs as opposed to the 2Ks. The HDR, the high dynamic range, is kind of a different animal. High dynamic range.
Wait, hang on a second. Hang on a second there, Jeff. You jumped right in, and I'm glad you did. HDR is really the key here, and I want to hear exactly what you have to say about it. But before we do, I would like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Zipcar. Now, Zipcar is the world's largest car-sharing network, operating in over 500 cities, towns, colleges, and more than 50 airports around the world. Zipcar provides a cost-effective alternative to car ownership. Zipsters only pay for the time they actually use a vehicle and have no responsibility for additional costs. You can drive cars by the hour or by the day, with gas and insurance included. With Zipcar, you'll have the freedom to choose when and where you want to drive. Zipcar's self-service vehicles are available on demand in conveniently located reserved parking spots in your neighborhood. Reserve your Zipcar in minutes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by calling or visiting the website. Simply book the vehicle of your choosing and unlock your selected vehicle with your Zipcard. Zipcar offers over 50 makes and models of cars that range from environmentally friendly hybrids, EVs, and PHEVs to luxury vehicles, SUVs, pickup trucks, and cargo vans. You'll have the option to choose the make, model, type, and even color of the vehicle you want based on the needs of each trip and the available Zipcars in your area. Reserving, accessing, and using a Zipcar is as easy as getting cash from an ATM. And car sharing is good for the environment. Zipsters reduce their personal CO2 emissions by between 1,100 and 1,600 pounds per year. For wheels when you want them and $25 in driving credit, go to joinzipcar.com/twit. That's joinzipcar.com/twit. And we thank Zipcar very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Okay, Jeff, I'm sorry to have interrupted you there. You were about to tell us about the HDR part of this equation. You're going to get a 4K TV, probably. There's a 4K TV in your future, and 1080p looks better on it than it does on a 1080p TV, typically, because of the good quality of the upscaling. How does HDR, or high dynamic range, fit into this picture?
Okay. High dynamic range has been in development for some time in this context, and it's frequently touted as an add-on feature to Ultra HD. It's one of the things that makes it ultra. The dynamic range, how black is the blackest part of the scene and how bright is the whitest part.
Brightest part, yeah.
The specular highlights, the glint of sunlight off of a car bumper, something like this. In high dynamic range, that range of detail is much more visible. You're capturing it in the content as well as the TV set. And this is a great deal, in fact, of what people were showing at the Innovation Zone. Ron already mentioned he was showing a camera that's capable of capturing this high dynamic range and made a fascinating demonstration, actually, to kind of raise my point. His camera gave an output in full HD in 1080p. It also makes 4K output with the high dynamic range. And the displays that he showed it on in his booth, unfortunately, I think, Scott, you might have a picture of it, but you can't tell because the devices we used to take photographs of his booth had standard dynamic range. And when you look at them on your computer screen or your broadcast, you're still looking at it with a standard dynamic range. But close,
we have a picture
live,
of that called Grass Valley Demo, I think, Josh, if you can find that. There it is.
Yeah. What you would see if you were looking at this live, that lower screen there is a standard dynamic range screen, and the bulb looks just like all of the bulbs there do. It's a little hazy. You can't really see any filaments in it and so on. The upper two, and Ron can give you the details on them, but the upper two are both high dynamic range displays, one with a peak brightness of 1,000 nits, the one on the left, and the one on the right with 2,000 nits. And in both of those, if you looked inside that light bulb, you'd be able to see the individual filaments of the bulb. As Ron pointed out to a number of people as they came up, that's sort of the thing that catches your eye as you walk by the display there. But what really gets your attention after that is looking at the base of the bulb and below it in the dark part of the picture. In both of the high dynamic range displays, you can see detail, the bolts holding the base together, and some different colors in the metals that are down there in that dark area. And those in the standard dynamic range are pretty much just all a mottled dark area in the photo. So the high dynamic range piece, and that photo was taken way more distance away from those displays than is relevant to the resolution. The resolution happened to have been 2K. It could have been 4K, and the visual impact, even for the live person standing in front of it, would have been no different. And the difference in picture image quality that you can see on even the large consumer displays, that's something you can see and point out from across the room. Not just to sit close and do this. If you are in a typical American living room 9 feet from your screen, that high dynamic range is going to make an impact that you're going to appreciate and remember. The 4K difference is not going to be something that you may feel good about it, that you got four instead of two of those things that you bought at the store, but The high dynamic range is going to be the piece that actually delivers the value. And this is the point that I was trying to bring out, the presentation that I gave. As broadcasters now with the ATSC 3.0 are gaining the ability to add more bits into the bit stream that is broadcast, they can use it for 4K. They can use it for higher frame rate. They can use it for higher dynamic range and actually a range of other interactive features and so on. The ATSC 3 is quite an upgrade in the broadcast infrastructure that's coming. But as they weigh the relative value to the delivery in the home, the impact of this high dynamic range is really where I think a lot of them, and I was trying to reinforce this from the standpoint of the main program at the Tech Retreat here, that just because 4K HDR is being built into the TVs, that means that the upscaling from 2K HDR content is going to happen quite well. You'll get good resolution, but you'll get a new experience with the high dynamic range.
Mm-hmm. And Ron, as you mentioned earlier, the broadcasters are probably more interested in HD 1080p with high dynamic range than they are with 4K because they've already got the infrastructure in place for 1080p. Is it going to be much to add HDR to what they already use?
No, not at all. It's part of the signal flow.
Mm.
So it's really not a great overhead for them to do. It's actually more the monitoring. So if I can get back to what Jeff described in the three monitors.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
I used the light bulb and the filaments. Now, that filament was brighter than looking at the sun. So it was always white. But if you could stare at it for more than 4 or 5 seconds, it was a bright yellow, although it emitted a white light. And because the camera goes into what we call clips, which is the high end, the filament was white. So the SDR, the standard dynamic range, you saw the bulb as it is on the pictures there. It's just one big white blob.
Right.
And the monitor up on the left at 1,000 nits. Nits is a unit of measurement of luminance, how bright
brightness.
It is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at 1,000, I can see the filaments, and that's nice. Then you go over to the Dolby monitor on the right, which goes to 2,000 nits. You saw more.
More detail in the filament itself.
Ah, but as Jeff pointed out, when you looked at the base, when you go into the dark, I had several people look at that, then look at the 1,000 nits, then go over and look at the SDR, and look at the SDR, and they said, why is that out of focus? Well, it's not out of focus. So the benefit of HDR, there's several great benefits to the consumer, and when these sets get, you know, calmed down to what they're displaying, is that if you have an envelope of a signal, if I get my graphic here straight, is about this big.
Right.
Okay.
Then that's standard dynamic range.
Right. Then you take high dynamic range that goes 15 stops above that. So that's quite a bit of light now coming in.
Yeah.
Well, HDR handles the 15 stops over. So of one of the standards, the 2084, which is they call PQ, the standard is written, believe it or not, to 10,000 nits. That's like looking at the sun.
Well, because not quite.
When
the sun is a billion nits when you look directly at it. But still.
But when your eye cuts off, who cares?
Yeah, right.
So you have all of this range, this big range. Now, what happens is when you have the high range, there's more light coming into the sensor. And if you have an iPhone, there's an HDR mode on it. And if you're shooting outside in this blue sky with white clouds, you take a regular photo, the white clouds are just a white blob. But if you turn on the HDR and take the photo, you see all of the texture in that cloud. that is where the added, I hate to use the word resolution, but the clarity of the details.
The perception of detail.
Right. So in the case of what Jeff was describing with the bulb, when you looked at the base of the bulb in the lamp itself and in the dark areas, it looked much sharper. Well, it actually is much sharper. But the sharpness depends on how much light you're displaying. The camera is putting out the same signal. But what is the display showing? So at 2,000 nits, it was really sharp, and everybody loved that. You looked at the 1,000, and you go, it kind of looks out of focus. And you look at the standard, and it was like, that's way out of focus. Mm. Well, that standard dynamic range is what you're getting today. So progressing moving forward with the displays getting better, and they're now handling the HDR of whatever standard, whether it's PQ, HLG, LMS, whatever standard it is, it's not so much that the clouds are now visible. What it is the picture itself is perceptually sharper. It's clearer. You're seeing more detail. So what does that all translate to the consumer? What that means is if you're watching the football game, especially the college football that are done in these stadiums that have been around for a long time, and they're usually at noon, 1 o'clock, half of the stadium is in a shadow and half of it is in sun. Mm. And right now, the video operator's shade for the field, the dark, so it's of proper video level, and the stands and the other half of the field are blown into clips. It's all just blown out white, and everybody sees it. It's been that way forever. With right. high dynamic range, everything is visible and sharp. So there's no riding the iris and compensating for the dark area. And then when the guy pans into the bright sun, he's pulling the iris down to make a 1-volt picture, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's now set the iris at 5-6 and let it go, because the camera is now capable of not only the bright sun side of the stadium, but it's also you're seeing all the detail on the shadowed side and the players on that side of the field.
Right. Didn't you tell me that there's actually, in addition to the cameraman at like a sporting event like that, there's another person actually adjusting the exposure as he moves around depending on what the camera's picking up?
Yeah, that's the video operator, the guy in the truck.
Oh, okay. I thought there was a separate guy at the camera, but okay, he's in the truck. Still, it's two people having to right. coordinate their activity, their action, as the camera moves around from bright areas to dark areas with high dynamic right. range. You're not going to have to deal with that at all.
Have to deal with that at all. Not at all. And that's the purpose of the demonstration, is showing that I can have this light bulb, full bright. I can now see the detail in the filament. I can see the base. I can see the clarity in the dark area, because you've got such a greater contrast ratio in when you take the signal from my little graphic here mm-hmm. and you now stretch it, you have more steps of gray. So you get more detail and you get more steps of gray. You have a greater contrast ratio. The temporal perception is that it is sharper, because you got more light hitting that sensor on the camera.
And the cameras these days are perfectly capable of doing, of right. representing or capturing this high right. dynamic range, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, the camera that I'm using right now, okay.
Yeah.
The picture is somewhat good, but if I do this, boom, it's blown out in
right,
high
because
dynamic
it's
range.
It's starting to expose for the light behind you.
Right. In high dynamic range, you wouldn't see that white blob. You'd actually see the detail on the other, that's a mirror, you'd see it on the other wall. So it does have its benefits. And the cameras, your cell phone cameras have high dynamic range in it. And that's one of the things that they put in there, because when you shoot that great photo on your vacation, all the stuff, the white clouds or, the fireworks or whatever you're shooting, if you turn that mode on your, I have an iPhone, on my iPhone, And the iPhone takes two pictures. It takes a standard and a high together. You can see the difference, and it's amazing. I did a camera training in Salt Lake for some video operators, and they kind of, and we went out to dinner and went out on the street in Salt Lake at night, and I told the guys, take your iPhones out and take the picture. And half of them said, I had no idea that this function was even in the camera. Look at the difference of the picture. And I said, and that's exactly what the cameras, the television cameras are doing. And that's what's going to be transmitted. So when you get this TV and everything Jeff just said, you're going to see a better picture. So if you're in 1080p HDR, it's, oh my God, look what we've got in the quality of the image. And it comes for free.
Essentially, for bandwidth free.
Right. So it's
costs
it's,
a little bit of, it adds a little extra bandwidth, right? But not very much.
No, it, basically insignificant. So what we were saying, I had the left monitor, the 1000 nits monitor is a HD, UHD monitor. I had it in UHD, HDR. And as I'd go between 1080p and 3840, the guys, the professional people at this conference are looking at me saying, I don't really see much of a difference there.
And these are golden eyes.
Exactly. And there was a panel, I forget what panel it was, Jeff, I'm quite sure you recall, where they had all the broadcasters on the panel, and all six of them said 1080p 60 HDR. That's what's worth doing. So,
Jeff, do you remember that panel?
Yeah, it was cleverly named the broadcasters panel. It was.
How would you possibly know that that's what they were going to talk about then?
that panel is one of the regulars on the HPA program. They they have folks who represent a number of different broadcast entities, NAB as well as CBS, Sinclair, a few others. And they really, it's an open forum kind of a discussion. Moderator walks them through a series of questions and the audience gets a chance to ask. This year it was pretty safe that ATSC 3.0 was going to be talked about. It was. And as Ron said, the general sense from that group when asked the question, are you planning to adopt ATSC 3.0, that first you have to do that because regular broadcast doesn't hold any of the stuff we've been talking about. The ATSC 3 provides an infrastructure to deliver these. And then within that infrastructure, it becomes complicated and they have to make choices. Which things are we going to exploit? And it was here that it was pretty much a unanimous sense that yes, 3.0 has a lot of capabilities of value. 4K is one of the possibilities. It's actually been done, tested in a few trials, and it is possible to get 4K with high dynamic range through a broadcast signal and once the infrastructure is built out that way. But the high dynamic range part in a full HD signal is a lot less bits. It's a lot less work in the workflow to get from the camera to your home set. If you're carrying 4K, there are other places where the number of bits involved, the storage, the processing, post-production, and so on, before it ever gets to your living room. All of those, the 4K carries a cost burden. And I think the unanimous sense of the panelists in this particular group were 4K sometime, probably HDR, much more near term. It's either on their roadmap and they're scheduling it now, or they're very seriously engaging it. 4K's much farther off, and I don't think any of the broadcasters that I spoke to, either on or off the record, were indicating that they thought 4K was going to be a near term requirement or build out for them.
Okay. Well, I want to talk more about ATSC 3.0, so bear with me for a moment while I thank our other sponsor for this program, which is BarkBox. BarkBox delivers 4 to 6 natural treats and fun toys for your dog, curated around a surprise theme each month. BarkBox paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys to match your dog's unique needs, including allergies and heavy chewer preferences. All edibles are made in the USA or Canada, and 100% of their products are tested on animals, their own. BarkBox is a great way to try a variety of treats and toys from local and small businesses that you may not otherwise be able to find. BarkBox also makes their own products through their Bark & Co. brand. They've shipped over 16 million toys and treats so far. Getting started is easy. Choose your dog size, small and cute, up to 20 pounds, just right, 20 to 50 pounds, or big and bold, 50 or more pounds. Choose a plan, 1, 6, or 12-month plans are available, and get your BarkBox. BarkBoxes are shipped on the 15th of each month. BarkBox will keep your dog engaged, interested, and happy. If your dog doesn't like something in the BarkBox, they'll send you something else for free. Scout's honor. When your dog falls in love with something from the box, you can easily find it again on BarkShop.com or the BarkBox app. You can cancel any time, and shipping is free in the continental United States. So give your dog the joy of a million belly scratches. Get 1 month free and free shipping with your 6 or 12 month subscription by visiting getbarkbox.com/twit. That's getbarkbox.com/twit. And we thank BarkBox very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Okay, we're talking about the HPA Tech Retreat. Jeff Tully and Ron Williams were both there. And so was Joe Kane. And he was going to be on the show today, in fact. He's been a multiple-time guest on the show as well. But he's got jury duty, so he couldn't be here. But he did send along a couple of comments. And I wanted to read the one he had to say about ATSC 3.0. And see what you have to think about it. He said, ATSC 3.0 and Spectrum Auction are going to be disruptive to the broadcast industry. As much as broadcasters are hopeful for the voluntary system, there is still a requirement to keep ATSC 1.0 on the air. That's the current broadcast system. Channel packing current ATSC stations is probably going to reduce image quality, and you'll need ATSC 3.0 just to get back to what we already have. So, Ron, what do you think about that?
I kind of agree with most of what he said. I think the circle that you just described, quoting Joe, is pretty much it. You're going to go to 3.0, and it has an enormous amount of capabilities, along with the UHD, the HDR, the expanded audio, the data streams. The
interactivity, I think, is part of it.
Yeah. I was looking for a word. I don't see that really working, but yes.
It's interactive. Okay. It's there.
Data interactive. I think the commercial people and the Nielsen people are more interested in that than any real functional part. But
yeah, I think you're right.
It has a lot. And at NAB last year, I was involved in the first live transmission of 3.0 there in Las Vegas at the National Association of Broadcasters Convention. One of the television stations took their secondary transmitter, and they did ATSC 3.0, transmitted from the mountain tower down to, well, over the city, but the hall received it, brought it down, and put it into several TVs in this kind of innovation area. Mm-hmm. And it was the first actual transmission of the ATSC 3.0. And we did UHD, HDR. Dolby was pumping, I think, 12 or 16 channels of audio out of the 24 that it's capable of. Mm-hmm. But that was the extent of the test. But everyone was happy that it actually all worked.
Right.
So, it is there. But again, the stumbling block that, Jeff and I are talking about is it's an enormous cost for a television station to replace that transmitter. And they just did it. And then there was some talk, well, you don't have to replace the transmitter. You just have to replace the exciter, which is, you know, half of the cost. But then what do you do with the infrastructure at the TV station, getting it from the station to the transmitter? And there's just a lot of technical issues that, you know, in my opinion, that the TV stations, A, don't want to spend the time, nor do they have the money to do it. Now, agreed, it's a big step forward, and it's a huge technological advance that needs to be done, but when at what cost? That's
exactly
my opinion.
And there's the issue of, you know, is broadcast, how important is over-the-air terrestrial broadcast television with the very strong upswing in streaming and stuff like that? Jeff, do you think over-the-air broadcasting is becoming less and less relevant?
Well, there are a number of different components to that question. If over-the-air stays as it is, it will be less competitive to other methods of delivery. That's kind of one of the big goals of this ATSC 3.0, was to improve the overall viewing experience by bringing into the broadcast architecture, the system, the infrastructure that's there, the ability to play on the strengths of over-the-top streaming services and data services, what have you, but to also include the strength that you get with traditional broadcast. I mean, remember that when you are broadcasting a program, sending one program to many receivers, whether it's analog as it has been in the past or whether it becomes digital, that's sending a lot fewer bits over whatever infrastructure you're using than if you are sending, as most streaming programs do, one-to-one. If you tune in to watch a streamed movie, that stream that's coming to you is different from the stream that goes to Ron, the one that comes to me. There's some combining of signal and so on that makes it not horrifically wasteful, but the idea of one-to-many, which is key in the broadcast, is a much, in my opinion, a much smarter way to look at the architecture. When you want to do things that require uniqueness, like you want to send while you watch the Super Bowl, the three of us are going to watch the Super Bowl probably in real time as it happens. A broadcast of that gets the job done with the greatest efficiency. If you want to send you a Ford commercial and Ron a Chevy commercial and me a McDonald's commercial, which you can do in this new architecture, those individual customized ad insertions can be handled with a an internet protocol kind of delivery. And this one of the advancements is discussed in 3.0 is an integration between over the air and over the top delivery. There was an ATSC 3.0 workshop on Monday of the conference. It wasn't part of the basic program. The people who wanted to attend that signed up separately. Joe Kane and I both did attend that one. It was a half day on Monday that was exclusively dealing with ATSC 3, kind of an update from some of the same broadcasters that were on the panel on Wednesday, but talking in much more detail with some manufacturers and other folks that are building out parts of this architecture. And it is rich in features that I think will allow the broadcasters to add on services, change functions to make them more modern, more up-to-date. And the combination, I think, could make the broadcast infrastructure, the various services that they are already providing, is just going to enrich those and make them more capable.
Yeah. Certainly your point of combining or merging over the air and over the top, I had never thought of that before, but that's really true. OTA and OTT is one of the goals of ATS 3.0 and maybe the way to move terrestrial broadcast into the future. Mike Heiss is in the chat room. He was also at the HPA Tech Retreat for a little while. He couldn't join us today, unfortunately, but he is in the chat room. And he's saying the only studio person who didn't commit to HDR in the short term was Bob Seidel of CBS. Did either of you talk to Bob about this? What was your sense of that?
Yes, I know Bob very well. We did have a conversation. I don't think that they were against it.
But he Mike is saying he's the only one who didn't commit to doing it in the short term.
That's political network.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. I know that CBS Sports, and I deal with them all the time. I mean, they're all over the HDR because of what I described about stadiums and handling the light, the clarity, and all of the things that I went through before. I mean, if you stop and think of all of the sports venues and what the added value for HDR to sports, it's incredible. So, you know, I look forward to that. And I think that CBS Sports would, you know, kind of push at that point. Of course, you got talking heads in news. It's a mute point. But if you're talking anything outside, it's a big issue.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, yeah, did you want to weigh in there?
Well, yeah. I mean, Rob's lab that he runs for CBS in New York has been looking at all of these issues that we're discussing here, the HDR, the 4K, ATSC3. And in fact, it was mentioned in a couple of different sessions that he had put together some demonstrations of what the various capabilities looked like on consumer televisions, set them up for the benefit of the ATSC committee members and so on. So certainly you wouldn't want to leave the impression that he's not very committed to understanding and working with the groups to exploit these features. But he's also aware of the math. How are you going to pay for it? I think conversations that I've had with him and with others in the broadcast space, the idea of pushing so many bits into a 4K HDR because ultra HD means 4K HD to many people, and HDR just automatically goes with 4K. I think Rob's one of the people that does not buy that argument at all. And right. I think from his perspective, by the time CBS and he move into that space, what you'll get is a very well thought out, well engineered, high quality delivery system. That's what it's there for.
Yeah, CBS has been doing, I think they're on the forefront of the 1080p 60 HDR testing. So I know they're very much into that. The whole HDR thing, I don't know of anybody, as Jeff pointed out on the panel, or from broadcasters and production people that are not really going forward to. In fact, I had several people come up and want to know if Grass Valley would be open to shooting HDR of some of their events, kind of like a Mardi Gras, where you've got these outrageous colors and speculars and detail. And that is really what it's all about. And that was one of the things we didn't talk about, Scott, is going along with this is the new color standard 2020, which is a bigger, wider color gamut. And the new TVs, some of them I see now are capable of doing 2020 color.
Not quite. 2020 color, for those of you who don't know, is a wider range of colors. So wide, in fact, that it ends up being very close to the primaries, red, green, and blue, end up being very close to being what's called monochromatic or single wavelength. And that really can only be done with lasers and now probably with quantum dots. And that was another issue that was talked about at the tech retreat, was quantum dots. So you're right, Ron, that I think consumer TVs are moving in that direction, but they're not quite there yet.
All of our cameras and all of the monitors that you saw were all capable of doing 2020.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, the it was kind of funny.
Those are professional monitors, though.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To put this in perspective, and I didn't think of this till now, in my demonstrations, the speech, I bring the guys right into the booth and put them, 3 feet away from the display and look at it. And everybody's all oriented to that. And then I have them take a step backwards and I'd say, now look at the floor. I'm going to put up color bars. Because at the beginning, I put up color bars when people were staring at the monitors and they'd go, Jesus. Don't ever do that again.
You mean you went from the high dynamic range image to color bars?
Well, they're high dynamic range 2020 color bars. It's the same thing.
Right. Just put All right.
But when you're looking at the light bulb and you see all the dark things and everything Jeff and I have been describing about all of the clarity and everything in the dark areas. But when you put up color bars and you see full 2,000 nits at 2020 color, it is, God, give me a pair of sunglasses. What are you guys doing? And that's how bright it is. So that's why we're really anxious to see what the consumer manufacturers are going to do about either limiting on a display light to your eyeballs level, because we know what the signal is going to be. The signal is just like, as I've been describing with this, my little graphic here, it's 15 stops over. I mean, if you were sitting in the stadium, you'd put on sunglasses.
Yeah. Yeah. If you were in an outdoor stadium during the day for a game, you would put on sunglasses.
You'd put on
sunglasses. If it was a bright day. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And if you're sitting in front of that TV and it's that bright, you're going to reach for a pair of sunglasses.
I was just going to say, Rev Dansonite in the chat room is saying, I want a display warning, not limiting. I get that. I get that. The Reverend here had another comment I was looking for. Where did I see it here? I wanted to make sure I got it. Maybe it's already past the end of the buffer here. Mike Heiss said that Ron is correct. At the end of the day, they'll have to go with HDR to remain competitive. And I believe that's true. Compy 386 says, is 2020 gamut only achievable with quantum dots, or has it been achieved with more traditional display technology? It has not. Only quantum dots or laser projection.
Nope.
You don't think so?
I've got a... Well, Sony OLED monitor that does it, and the Dolby monitor is an LCD.
True, and it uses LED backlighting.
Oh, my God, LED backlighting.
Well, now the Pulsar, their first one goes to 4,000 nits, and it's liquid cooled. So you're not going to have that in a consumer's house.
This monitor that I was using is called a Maui. Now, let's keep in mind that Dolby does not make monitors. They make prototypes for somebody else to make them.
Right.
But the Maui does 2,000 nits, and it's a LCD, and it does all of the specifications. Now, they've got others
coming out. And it really gets out to 2020, real 2020 color space?
Real 2020.
Wow. I was not aware of that. I've learned something new today.
The other monitor I have is a Sony BVM X300, which does UHD.
That's the OLED,
and it does it quite well as well. But the funny part about it is when I put bars up and side by side between the Sony and the Dolby, everybody said, "Well, why is the color saturated on the Dolby?" Well, it really isn't, because when you push out that far, not only does the luminance goes up, the chroma goes up as well. When you're in 2020 color, because they're kind of locked together.
And to a certain degree, yeah. But the colors can only go so high. For example, blue is only 10% of white. Right? So if you push white to 2,000 nits, blue is only going to be 200 nits.
Right. But where is magenta and red going to go?
They're going to be higher. They're certainly going to be higher. Green's going to be the highest of all.
Right. And that little white block is blinding.
Yeah. Tinker Toy Tech in the chat room is suggesting that multicast is built in and seldom used part of the TCP IP address space. I didn't know that. Did you guys?
Nope, I didn't know that.
Okay, well, then it's sort of already there.
You're right.
There you go. Let's see. Is there anything else we want to make sure to talk about? Because our time is rapidly growing to a close.
The tech retreat, they had an interesting Mark Childress at Grass Valley moderated a panel about mobile live productions and how that whole paradigm is shifting, is that there's NEP, a big production, sports production truck company worldwide now. Mm-hmm. They've gone to what they call at home, where when they do a baseball game, there's no truck there. They just put the cameras and the talent and an audio guy, and everything is shipped to wherever home base is. I did one for a Fox preseason baseball game where in the stadium there were six cameras and everything else was in L.A. So there's a lot of sporting companies moving towards that.
It would cost a lot less to not have to roll a truck. And I mean, we're talking a real semi here.
Right.
To a location. If you can. But how is all that data transported? Is it over IP? Is it over the internet?
Well, NEP uses a system that was designed by Grass Valley and Breda Holland, where they take the data, actually their ID'd packets, out of the camera head, and it goes into, because it's data, goes into a typical IP COTS switch. And then whomever is doing it, you order in like a 40 gig line between point A and point B, and everything goes down that line. And it gets to the other end into another COT switch and gets broken out to audio goes this way and each camera goes over here and the intercom goes over here. So they're seeing that they're not paying airfare for all the cameramen and production people and hotels and meals and all of that. Along as you pointed out, they're not rolling a truck. So the cost savings to do the sporting event is enormous. In London, they did, NBC did half of the closing ceremonies. All the video operators and audio for that part were in Secaucus, New Jersey.
For the Olympics, you mean, in London.
Right. So it's becoming more and more popular. One other topic on that same panel was what the use of drones are. They're now finding that ENG trucks for their local news now are flying
ENG,
drones.
ENG, by the way, means electronic news gathering, just for those who don't know.
Right. They're flying drones to cover the story instead of bringing the television station helicopter in to cover whatever's going on.
Oh, that's interesting.
The guy in the little truck is up flying a drone because the drone is putting out 1080p60 back to the truck. So they're getting a high quality image from the drone. You know, if there's a big car accident or a fire or something like that.
Or in LA, a chase. We see those very often.
Right. And they also discussed the use of drones for communication in faraway places like third world countries. They're also using it for communications to some outlying isolated areas. So this company, Jeff, what was it, Gorilla Video or Video Gorilla?
Video Gorillas, yeah. Jason Burns.
Video Gorilla. If you want to look that company up, they do end-to-end so many extremes use of video and audio in drones. So that's another model that production for television is moving into. That session was very, very informative.
Mm-hmm.
Very informative.
Jeff, how about you? Any last thoughts about HPA? Anything we haven't covered you want to make sure we at least touch upon?
Well, it's such a broad spectrum. We hit the ones that Ron and I think found the most compelling. I know Joe was likewise, kind of too bad he couldn't join us here. He was also engaged with the ATSC, the broadcasters, and the and the support under the high dynamic range in whatever form of production it is.
I think that's what we can look forward to in the future. And what I'm looking forward to in the future, particularly, is high dynamic range. And in broadcasting, I think it makes a lot of sense to do high definition 1080p at 60 frames per second in high dynamic range more than it makes sense to do 4K, as we've talked about extensively on the show. So
your
presentation was good.
Yeah, I don't think it precludes getting to 4K, but one of the things we were certainly hearing with people here, and you know, we sort of alluded to the fact that there are multiple flavors of HDR, and that's really in the packaging and transmission. That'll get worked out. The underlying value of high dynamic range, and the fact that if the standard doesn't come one way of delivering high dynamic range, if it's two or three, it was pointed out LG Electronics, I think, supports most, if not all, of the formats of HDR transmission. So whatever
they do,
form gets used. I think Samsung has introduced a custom one of their own, and I believe LG did not express great enthusiasm for that different one.
Blood enemies.
they had, you know, the four others were supported. Samsung had a very nice demonstration in the demo area of their approach and how it works. It is similar in a sense to the Dolby Vision high dynamic range in that it has what they call dynamic metadata about the dynamic range. As you go from one scene to the next, you can be adjusting the display so that as you're shooting scenes that are mostly dark or different scenes in the same production, maybe a lot of sky and so on, by having dynamic metadata about the HDR, the high dynamic range, you can show more of the value, the detail, and so on, compared to what are called the static dynamic range. All of those elements, however, are, you know, part of the politics of features and standards getting set and built. I think they're going to move along well. The value that I think of more and more people looking at high dynamic range is getting in the production value. What do creative people really want to do with all that extra dynamic range? It's not terribly interesting to make the whitest part of every picture 2,000 nits.
Super bright.
Whatever the display can do at that moment. You know, if you put more than a small glint of sunlight off the bumper, if you take, you know, 30% of your shot is the sky, you don't want that much of your TV screen at 2,000 nits. As Ron was saying, look down at the floor before I switch to the color bars and look back and let your eyes adjust to it. Don't smack that in there. Mm-hmm. But there are elements about the creative process that are only going to happen when people have the ability to create the HDR, look at the differences that it makes in the content, and then use that, integrate it into the storytelling, which is what the movies and TV shows are all about in the first place. You know, can you enhance the storytelling? Can you make the value greater to the consumer in one way or another? And I think we saw a lot of that, the seeds of that, coming along there. There was one last thing that I have to throw out. We didn't really speak much about this. Ron did a little bit with the remote production, but production in the cloud-based editing and things like this. That's a big deal in the post-production community these days of, how much of your stuff to do production and post-production lives in your truck or in your building in the facility and how much of it is actually off-premises in the cloud. And there was one demonstration of that where on a panel, the discussion of the value that can come from having this distributed resource. And they did go live with that demo to show everybody, you know, from the speaker's podium, what it's like to have your production in the cloud. At that moment, the internet connection to the hotel failed, and we got to see a blank screen and have a good conversation about one of the types of pitfalls of cloud-based production. And if you got the camera in your hand and it's working, that's great, and it records onto the camera. If it's recording into the cloud and you lost the internet connection, you lost all the shots.
You're right. That is a problem. Yeah. Let me end with a couple of quick questions from the chat room. THX1138 says, are all broadcasters backing HLG, which is one of the four high dynamic range formats that we're currently dealing with? And also, what is LMS? Ron, you mentioned LMS.
LMS is a flavor of HLG, which is hyper log gamma, is what
hybrid
the HLG
log
stands.
gamma, right. Yeah.
And the LMS is the simple term, large, medium, and small of the color packet levels that where the curves of the signal go. So okay. You control the three different levels.
So is HLG, was that probably going to be the high dynamic range format for broadcasting?
Broadcasters like that a lot. And it was going quite well. HLG was a consortium of the NHK and the BBC. Right. And everybody thought that that was really great and was going forward. But about 3 weeks ago, the BBC said, well, you know, where that white point curve is, we kind of don't like that anymore. So we're going to change the BBC HLG.
Oh, no, really?
So I don't know whether NHK is going to say, yeah, okay, fine, let's do that. Let's stay together so everybody's doing the same. But that's the nature of how standards go. I mean, they're all looking for a standard. You know, when I write standards for SMPTE and the Academy, we look to write a standard for 50 years. We hope that it'll stand for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So all of this changing that's going on, you know, at the beginning, it's kind of normal because you want to sort it out and get everything dampened down and all of the complaints out of the way. So when you do release the standard, going down another 3 or 4 years, if somebody says, well, you know, this could have been better. And we say, yeah, it could have been. But at the time we wrote it, it wasn't. So let it ride until it outlives its usefulness, and then we'll revisit it. SMPTE revisits every standard every 5 years. It's a five-year review. Mm. And they look at the standard and say, well, you know, technology is taking a leapfrog forward, so we'll go back and revisit it and adapt to what the current technology is. So that's how that process works. The HLG seems to have the greatest popularity.
Among broadcasters.
Yeah. Jeff pointed out with the PQ, the Dolby standard, it's metadata that is dependent on things, where HLG just says, this is the signal that's coming in, and this is what we do with it, and we know it's locked in all the way through. Mm-hmm. And everybody likes that approach rather than something that's dynamic.
Right. Now, Mike Heiss in the chat room is reminding me that the Samsung system that Jeff mentioned is called HDR10 Plus, which is basically HDR10, what we now have on Ultra HD Blu-ray discs and some streaming content, which is static metadata. That is only one piece of data for what's the brightest moment in this whole program and what's the average level in the whole program.
Right.
As opposed to HDR10 Plus or Dolby Vision, which has dynamic metadata that says what's the brightest and medium point in each frame. That's just to bring that to close that loop, as they say.
Right.
I wanted to mention that.
It is dynamic scene to scene is what they do, and mm-hmm. some people like it, some people object to it, but I think all in all, the HLG is going to survive. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a place for the PQ, and there's a place for the others. Certainly a place for the PQ, because being mm-hmm. dynamic at that level, you know, you're going to have to deal with it. But I think standard broadcast is going to be HLG. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Well, listen, we're kind of over time here. I'm thank you so much for hanging with me, and thank the audience for geeking out with us, because it's gotten pretty geeky here, but I sure do appreciate it. That's Jeff Tully and Ron Williams, both entertainment technology consultants and regular guests on the show. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out much more about HPA, the Hollywood Professional Association, at hollywoodprofessionalassociation.com. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg. And on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be journalists Robert Herron, Chris Boylan, and Caleb Dennison, who were all with me at in San Francisco this week, actually putting the LG W7 OLED TV through its paces. And I'm really looking forward to talking with them about all that we learned about that. In this kind of special event that we all attended. So I do hope you will join us. Until then, geek out.